On the morning of April 7, 1968, church bells rang for Palm Sunday, and in East Baltimore, those who ventured out of their homes saw their neighborhoods transformed into war zones.
What you saw was smoke and fire.
Sergeant Bishop Robinson was one of the few black police officers with rank on the Baltimore force in 68.
What you saw was smoke and fire, lines of storefronts all burning at the same time, and more being burned by individuals who were throwing those Molotov cocktails.
All around me, everywhere I looked, was fire.
Michael Olesker was 22 years old, 3 months out of college, and a reporter for the News American, assigned to cover the riots.
It was just buildings going up in flames everywhere, and pockets of people, sometimes hundreds of them, running through tear gas, throwing rocks through windows, with sirens all around and smoke all around. And there was this moving pocket of scores of people, and suddenly, for no apparent reason, they would change direction.
The night before, the city had imposed a curfew from 11 to 7 a.m. in an effort to stop the looting and burning. But as soon as the curfew lifted, the rioters were out again. Two pillars of the black community drove through the streets together to survey the situation and see what they could do to bring things under control. Homer Favor, a professor at Morgan State, and Reverend Miriam Bascom of Douglas Memorial Community Church watched the chaos philosophically. Bascom was Baltimore's first, and at the time, only member on the city's fire board.
I don't think you could say anything but to deliver your presence there. The terrible stench of smoke that could be seen across the city, vandals loose in the field.
We saw a lady, a lovely lady, nondescript, had two or three children. And they knocked the window out to a cleaning shop. And next door was a liquor store. And she had the bottles of liquor, and they had the clothes that they took out of the cleaning. And we spoke to her and said, mind your own business.
The owners of the stores were trying desperately to mind their own businesses. Young Billy Murphy drove around the city with his father, William H. Murphy, one of the city's prominent lawyers.
I remember seeing those signs. It said, Soul Brother, Soul Brother, Soul Brother. In other words, don't bomb me. Bomb the white man. Aim your rage correctly. It's a pitiful artifact of history.
Murphy remembers a white shop owner who tried the same tactic.
It was Jewish business. The man was smart enough to understand how to ward off damage. It worked for a little while until somebody ratted him out, and then his business got burned down too.
Other merchants used different means to protect their livelihoods. Gerald Lewis was watching the news on television with his father, who owned the Excelsior Cleaners on Edmondson Avenue.
As we were watching the TV, and we saw that the riot was coming up from Gay Street up to Hilton Street, I said to my father, I want to go over and protect the store. And my parents were not too happy about that. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to lose my livelihood just to stand idly by and watch.
Lewis grabbed a shotgun and drove over to the family's main plant on Edmondson. The windows and front door were broken. People were coming out with armloads of clothing. And two officers sat outside in a squad car.
As I made the U-turn and pulled up behind them, I said, what's going on? I said, they've broken into my location, and you're just sitting there. He said, we have orders not to do anything. I said, okay. I said, will you protect me as I go into my place? They said, you better stay outside, because we can't protect you once you go inside. They had broken in the windows and the front door, and there were people running out with armloads of clothes. So in order to put a stop to that, I walked to the front door, fired one shot into the air. That got everybody's attention, and they all started running out. After the store had been cleared out, I went inside, turned the lights on, and stayed there for the rest of the evening. There was a liquor store next to me, and there were two owners, or partners, and they were sitting on the roof at the front of the store, and they were sitting there with two rifles, and they weren't touched. After I got to my location, nobody came in.
Lewis says the owners of two liquor stores next door stood guard on their roofs that night, also armed with rifles. But most merchants were helpless to stop the destruction and retreated to wait it out. On Harford Road, four blocks south of North Avenue, the Harford Cleaners was on fire.
Somebody had thrown a gasoline bomb into the store. A 3-inch gas main burst, and the steel girders just melted like spaghetti. Burned out, totally.
College student Jim Constantinidis says the family hadn't heard from his uncle, George Sapunas, who owned the store. Then they got a phone call from some of the employees.
His employees, his loyal employees that he had, who he had paid well and taken care of, true to form with him, called us up and said, Uncle George is down in the basement, we're taking care of him. And when things cool down, come and get him.
The Harford Cleaners' black employees had whisked Sapunas out of the store when the trouble started and hidden him in a nearby home. A couple of days later, when it was safe, Constantinidis went to get his uncle. He found the Greek immigrant standing with his cane, looking at the destruction. The young ones didn't know him, he said, or else they wouldn't have burned him out.
Just shrugged his shoulders. He didn't even have insurance. He didn't believe in insurance. He was tough. He figured all the money that he'd saved over the years, it just came out even. The only thing he was sad about was the city gave him so little for his property. But otherwise, it was finished. He was able to take that. What he was sad about was the phenomena, the social phenomena surrounding the destruction of his place and Baltimore.
As the evening approached on Sunday, the east side began to calm. Now it was time for the west side to erupt. For the first time since the Civil War, there were federal troops in Baltimore. President Lyndon Johnson gave the order at 6:14, and shortly thereafter, the 82nd Corps Airborne Infantry from Andrews Air Force Base came down Park Heights Avenue with fixed bayonets. Most were only a few years older than the teenagers playing hit-and-run maneuvers with them, but it wasn't a game. There were reports of gunfire between snipers and troops. At 8:30, Governor Spiro Agnew appeared on television announcing new curfew hours. By now, the city jail was overflowing with people caught looting, and thousands who'd been rounded up for violating the curfew. Things were bad, but not everyone, and certainly not all black Baltimoreans, were affected in the same way.
My world wasn't really interfered with because I could get back from work and without a problem.
Peggy Johnson was a nurse at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Driving to work from the middle-class neighborhood of Edmondson Village, she saw no signs of trouble.
They made a corridor. In other words, I could leave my house and go straight to Hopkins without a problem, without seeing anything. Downtown, Charles Street, Mondawmin, they blocked it. They stopped it. There was almost like an invisible line at Bentlow Street.
But the invisible line of cordoned off streets couldn't protect Peggy Johnson's son from coming home from elementary school to tell her about a puzzling question a white teacher had asked him.
The school that he attended was predominantly white. And he came home and he said, Mom, my teacher asked me, wanted to know if we were riding. No, we don't do that.
Peggy Johnson told her son, we don't do that kind of thing. And she marched down to the school to give the principal and the teacher a piece of her mind. A world away from Edmondson Village, Melvin Williams was just getting up at his mother's house in the 1400 block of West Madison Street.
Early in the morning, looked out and all I saw was Army vehicles. I said, damn. I want to talk to you. I said, okay, always.
It was Major George Gelston in charge of the National Guard, Box Harris, the city's highest-ranking black police official, and a childhood friend of Melvin's, Clarence Mitchell Jr. of the NAACP.
General George Gelston in charge of the National Guard of the 5th Regiment Army. Major Box Harris, who was the largest police officer, black police officer at that time, and Senator Clarence Mitchell III came to my house and said, Melvin, we want you to come with us and hopefully stop the people from rioting. And I said, why me? They said, because it appears that you have the audience captivity syndrome going for you right now, that they seem to listen to you when you say something. And so I said, well, let's go. Let's see if that holds true. And if it does, I'm delighted. If it doesn't, I hope you don't hold it against me.
The men drove to West Mosier Street near Pennsylvania Avenue and got out.
Major Harris said, take this bullhorn and this bulletproof vest, and we off. And so I says, well, I can take the bullhorn, but the bulletproof vest, I couldn't wear that because this is the same neighborhoods that I'm in all day, every day. And it seemed like I would be punking out if I took a bulletproof vest today and, you know, I didn't wear it any other time. So let's proceed with that in mind. And so we rode to all of these different places.
Melvin climbed up on some boxes and addressed the crowd of about 300 to 400 people.
After we rode to several of these places and I got out of the car and stood on a box or on a car's hood or roof and said that you have taken all that there is to take out of this black community. You've taken the heart out of your own area. But more importantly, I've been told by this general that in the event that you cross Howard and Franklin streets, those two streets that divide the things that belong to the powers that be and white America, they're going to kill you wholesale. They're going to kill you all in a manner that will let it be known that this is something that we will not tolerate. And they tolerated it as long as we were destroying black things. But they made it clear that you can take Pipe Rack and Cookies and Rodman's and all of those places. You can destroy as much of it as you choose. But again, if you cross Franklin and Howard, we're going to open fire and we're going to kill you all wholesale. If you need to go home, if you go across Howard and Franklin, they're going to kill you. You need to go home immediately. There's going to be a curfew. Go in. Do not allow them the opportunity to dog you, to beat you up. And everybody dispersed and went home.
Whether it was Melvin's words, the sight of federal troops with rifles and bayonets, the angry warnings of Governor Agnew on television, or just exhaustion, by Monday, the looting and the fires began to wane. By Wednesday at 2 o'clock, Mayor Tommy DeLisandro was at Memorial Stadium and threw out the first ball to open the baseball season. The city of Baltimore was back in business. At least some parts of it were. 6 people were dead, shot by police bullets or burned to death in buildings that were torched. 700 people were injured. Hundreds had police records for curfew violations that would take years to expunge. Property damage amounted to some $10 million. Several weeks after the riots, Frank Nutt began to compile data for his family's construction and insurance business and saw a strange pattern emerge.
We were asked by the insurance companies to try to determine whether there was any pattern to buildings that were damaged. And because we had evaluated hundreds and hundreds of buildings, what I thought was rather random turned out to be not so random. There were 3 categories of buildings that were in the top 3 in terms of numbers that were hit. The dry cleaner in the neighborhood was number 1. Number 2 was the liquor stores. And number 3 were the corner grocery stores.
Why these stores and not others? The reasons were rooted in the everyday life of the neighborhoods.
The reason for the number 1, the dry cleaner laundry, when people sent their laundry to those places at that time, they would have the laundry to pay for it being clean on a layaway plan. And when they hit 30 days, if they didn't have it fully paid off, and I mean 100%, if the ticket was 90 cents and you put 80 cents down, you didn't get your laundry back, they sold it. Number two, the liquor stores, there weren't that many banks around that you could cash your check in. She cashed it at the liquor store. They were taking 20 and 30% of a check. And then the corner grocery stores had layaway plans. A bag of potato chips that might have cost you 10 or 15 cents might end up costing you 30 cents. Although the violence was very emotionally driven, my sense was that once it got started, people knew who the man was. You could be on a block and have stores that were totally damaged and stores that weren't touched. The businesses that had a relationship with the neighborhood and were not trying to take advantage of their situation, for the most part, didn't get touched.
The pattern of burning and looting had followed a route of racial insult to blacks in inner-city Baltimore. Still, few people back then would have guessed that the marks would still be visible 40 years later.
I'm standing here in what was once the Gay Street Corridor, one of the city's bustling commercial districts back in 1968. It used to be a street lined with storefronts, businesses, but now it's empty lots and rows of mostly deserted row houses. This street, this former commercial district, was the epicenter of the unrest that took place on the east side in the days following the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
The 68 riots, the fire last time, changed the landscape of Baltimore. They would make one man's political fortune and put a halt to another's ambitions. And they would forever change the way black and white Baltimoreans view themselves and their city. I'm Suni Khalid for WYPR.
Our series, 68, The Fire Last Time, was made possible in part by a grant from the Maryland Humanities Council. Special thanks to the University of Baltimore for their assistance in conjunction with this project. Tomorrow, Governor Spiro Agnew calls Baltimore's black leadership to a meeting and rides the riots all the way to Washington.
Wait, this is a trap, it's a trap. I called Parenticide, and Mary and I said, it's a setup. I explained to them that they'd already given them the news clip as to he's gonna cuss us out, and the cameras were up there rolling.
Join us tomorrow for part four of our series, 68, The Fire Last Time. You can also visit our website to listen to earlier segments and to see photographs of the aftermath of the riots. That's at WYPR.org.
God bless the child that's got his own will. That's got his own. And the strong seem to get more, while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grave, 'cause mama may have and papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.